Minnesota House of Representatives Committee on Public Safety and Criminal Justice Reform will come to order. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Mariani.
Present.
Vice Chair Frazier.
Present.
Representative Johnson.
Present.
Representative Edelson.
Present.
Representative Feist.
Present.
Representative Brussel. Excused. Representative Hollins.
Present.
Representative Hewitt.
Present.
Representative Cleavorne.
Present.
Representative Long.
Present.
Representative Lucero.
2 cups of coffee for 2 10:30 committees.
Representative Mueller.
Present.
Representative Novotny.
Novotny present, also on a split squad.
Representative O'Neill.
Still present.
Representative Pinto. Excused. Representative Poston.
Present.
Representative Raleigh.
Lee present.
Representative Vang.
Present.
Representative Zhang.
Here.
We have, that concludes roll call with 17 present.
Very well, members, the quorum is present, and I'll give Representative Lucero a few seconds to slip me over that second cup of coffee. Members, this hearing is being conducted remotely on an electronic platform pursuant to Minnesota House Rule 10.01, Emergency House Operations. That could be viewed on the Minnesota House webpage, as well as visiting the committee page on the Minnesota House webpage will provide the public with instructions on how to access this hearing via live stream video, as well as instructions for signing up and participating in public testimony. Representative Frazier, I wonder if you would be so kind as to move the minutes from February 25th.
Mr. Chair, I will move the minutes from February 25th.
Very well.
Chair Mariani.
Hold on a second. Members, Representative Frazier moves adoption of the minutes from February 25th. Representative Johnson.
There needs to be one clarification in the minutes. Edelson A2 amendment, I was one who requested the roll call, not you.
Very well. Let's make that correction, clerk. You have it?
Yes, I've noted it. Thank you.
Very well. Thank you. Thank you, Representative Johnson. Any further discussion? All right. Very well. Then Representative Frazier moves adoption of the minutes of February 25th with the amendment as stated by amended language stated by Representative Johnson relative to the Edelson bill. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
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 Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails, and the minutes as amended are from February 25th are adopted. Members, today we're going to hear a number of Department of Corrections policy bills. At times, these are going to be there's going to be testimony that I want to encourage everyone to enter into with open hearts and understanding as we hear from impacted individuals and as we consider our legislative approach, partly in response to their tragic incidents and circumstances with their loved ones. So we're going to have four bills. We're going to start with Representative Cagle. Welcome to the committee, Representative Cagle. I think this is your first time with us this year. It's good to have you here. Representative Cagle, the chair moves to refer House File 553 to the Transportation Committee. Representative Cagle, your bill is before us, and I believe you may want to move an author's amendment as well.
Yes, Mr. Chair, there's a DE amendment.
Very well. The chair will move the DE1 amendment, and Representative Cagle, I believe this puts the bill in the shape that you wish it to be before this committee for deliberation today. Is that correct?
Correct.
Very well. Representative Johnson, you okay with a voice vote on this? You might be muted, Representative Johnson.
Yes, I am.
Very well. Thank you. Discussion. All in favor of the of adopting the DE1 amendment, please say aye.
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 Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails, and House File 553, as amended, is before us. Representative Cagle, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and just like Representative Lucero, I'm in two places at once, which is kind of fun in the Zoom world. So I just want to thank you, Chair Mariani, and members of the committee. I'm delighted to be here with you to present this bill, the DE, as we just adapted to you, that contains original language from the Department of Corrections bill. Sophia Khan from the Department of Corrections is also here today to answer any questions you may have. DOC has worked closely with me and Senator Osmick, who is the chief author of this legislation in the Senate, over the past month to get the bill in its current shape. And I'm really excited to share this with you today. Much of this bill is similar to reentry legislation that passed in 2009 in New Jersey. Members, Section 1 of this bill deals with a really big barrier people reentering community from prison face, the lack of access to ID cards. In Minnesota, you need two forms of ID to get a state ID or regular driver's license, and this section simply provides that DVS can accept DOC or Federal Bureau of Prisons ID card as a secondary document. Other forms of secondary documents DVS can accept include school ID cards, government employee cards, and even certified court documents. To give you a better picture of how common this practice is, at least 22 other states have Department of Motor Vehicles that accept some form of department correction documentation as proof of identity. Section 2 codifies in law many current practices and policies that the DOC and adds other requirements into law for the department that will help people returning into the community succeed and become more productive members of our society. This section came from the Senate author and requires that the commissioner provide a range of information and assistance to those incarcerated upon release, such as general information on SNAP benefits, local career force work centers, access to their own medical records, accounting for court-ordered payments, and assistance with obtaining birth certificates and ID cards at no cost. The commissioner is also required to provide a one-month supply of non-narcotic medications that have been prescribed to the person incarcerated upon release, and also two 30-day refills. And the last section of this bill is really important, members. I sit on the Preventing Homelessness Subdivision and recently heard the department present some stunning data on the homelessness crisis faced by those returning to our communities. And you will hear more about this in a bit from DOC's Reentry Service Director, Kelly Heifert. This language would require the department to develop and implement a homelessness mitigation plan and report its progress. And the language will also require the DOC to report data related to release into homelessness and homelessness faced by those on supervision to the legislature. Members, parts of this language are within the jurisdiction of the Transportation Committee, for which I'm the vice chair, and it does need to go there next. Yesterday, the Senate Republican Caucus held a press conference that I was able to take part in on this bill, and it also passed out of its Transportation Committee with a unanimous vote. And it's heading to the Senate Judiciary next. And lastly, members, I believe the department has shared with you a packet of letters of support from a wide range of community organizations who work on the ground with people returning from prison to support them with reintegration into the community. With that, members, I urge you to vote yes on this bipartisan effort. As my colleague in the Senate said, this should not be controversial. It's a common sense bill that will help remove barriers for people. So thank you. And with that, I will turn it over to the testifiers.
Very well. Thank you, Representative Cagle, for your concise presentation. You know, I recently saw I think it might have been on the NewsHour extended piece on this issue covering instances in several other states. So I know that this is a challenge across the country, but there seems to be really good movement in a bipartisan manner across the country to provide the ability for our released individuals who have served and met their terms to be able to enter into society with just the most basic of needs, which is to be able to identify themselves and therefore be able to do all sorts of things that the rest of us take for granted. With that, we're going to move to your testifier, Kelly Heifer, the Department of Corrections Director of Reentry Services. Welcome to the committee. Kelly, please state your name for the record and give us your testimony.
Good morning. My name is Kelly Heifer.
Good morning. I think you may want to turn your volume up a bit.
Sure.
Unless it's my end. If anyone else has issues, let me know.
I can maybe get a little closer to share.
I can barely hear you. I can barely hear you. Why don't you hold up a second? Is anyone else having that issue? I just want to make sure it isn't just me.
I am as well.
Same chair.
I need to switch microphones.
Okay. Ms. Heifert, is it possible for you to either continue to play with that volume or to perhaps switch microphones? If you have a, what I'm told is if you have an earpiece, that sometimes that really helps.
I can certainly try. Bear with me. I apologize.
No, that's quite all right. This isn't the first time.
Mr. Chair, maybe I'll take this opportunity share a little bit about the fact that I also serve on the Opioid Epidemic Response Advisory Council, and many of these things that were brought forward are things that we have heard in the Opioid Epidemic Response Advisory Committee Council. And so when Senator Osmak brought this bill to me, I was really excited to see this because it is something that we've been hearing from folks that are being released or that deal with people that have been released. And so, you know, hearing about this in that committee and some of the barriers that people face, when Senator Osmak invited me to be part of this, I was super excited. I think this is a great piece of legislation and just really hope that we can get this done for folks.
I concur. Ms. Heifert, you said if you still need more time, that's fine. Don't feel rushed here. Meanwhile, why don't we have Representative Lucero? You can get us going with either questions or comments.
Perfect. I have to silence the other one, and so you don't hear the background noise. So thank you for this. Mr. Chair, I actually have two questions. I'll get them back out now, and they can be answered in whatever order. So the first question is for likely the department, and that is last year when you heard this bill, the question I would have is, it's my understanding that the prison ID will be given to inmates if this bill were to pass upon being released. So like other government-issued IDs, driver's license and others, there are extensive measures put into place to protect against altering the document. So same question I asked last time we had this bill, what protections are in place with the prison IDs that would prevent them from being altered when a person is released and is allowed to keep the ID? Second question then is for the bill author. If somebody is in prison, they're an illegal immigrant. They're not a permanent resident or not a citizen. What will happen in regards to them? Will this card, is there anything different with somebody's status who's, again, not legal?
Representative Cagle, to the question of undocumented individuals held and released in our prison? Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I might need to phone a friend on this, but I'm assuming that the DOC card is a secondary document. And so you'd still need to provide those primary documents when you're getting an ID card. And so if you don't have those, I'm assuming you wouldn't be able to get an ID card because you wouldn't have all of the documents that you need. And if somebody from the department wants to jump on and let me know if I got that one right or not.
Yeah, very well. Let's see if Ms. Raleigh might, Ms. Heifert, where did I get that? I was looking at Representative Raleigh's face here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
If Ms. Heifert might be available.
I agree with what was said. It's a secondary form of identification. So all of the primary forms would need to be met. So for undocumented people, they may or may not be able to meet those standards to get the state ID. So it doesn't serve necessarily as an additional form for undocumented people. Does that make sense?
I think so. Why don't we hear your testimony? Representative Lucero, I'll certainly come back to you because you had another question or comment. Go ahead. You sound terrific, by the way.
Great. Thank you. Thank you. And I apologize for that. We'll try my iPad as a better function. So thank you, Chair Mariani and members of the committee today. My name is Kelly Heifert, as I'd said earlier, and I serve Minnesota through the Department of Corrections as the Reentry Services Director. So on behalf of Department of Corrections and those partner organizations who submitted letters and many others, I want to thank Representative Cagle for working with us on this important legislation. Today, I'm here representing our department staff who do this work inside our correctional facilities, getting people ready to leave. And I carry messages and the support from community providers who work with impacted people every day and know what happens firsthand if they are not ready and fully prepared to be out in community. So the bill you have in front of you is critical for three reasons. And the first is that it codifies what we already aim to do in many circumstances. We have a dedicated staff of transitions coordinators at each facility. They teach pre-release classes trying to prepare people to leave. They currently process some identification documents through agreement with DVS. They make health insurance applications available to people and more. But this bill really assures that Minnesota is steadfast in the foundational best practices in bridging people to communities, like you've heard that other states have done, such as New Jersey, right back in 2009. So secondly, this bill stretches our ability and our capacity to really do new things that can make a difference. So one of those is what we're currently talking around, the secondary form of identification. If we're not able to help people before they release, get that identification, they could be one step closer in getting valid state ID on the outside because of that secondary form. So as Representative Cagle mentioned, government-issued IDs are already an acceptable form, just like my DOC badge that I have, right? It could be accepted as well as a school ID or other forms. So lastly, in the third place, this bill will really positively impact people who are trying to get on with their lives. It includes things like increasing the amount of non-narcotic medication and prescriptions so that people don't have to run out of that vital medication before their insurance kicks in or before they can navigate their way to find qualified insurance eligible and available providers. So I really think the homelessness mitigation plan that's at the end and the reporting requirements are very important. The bill charges DOC and folks like me to uncover the real data, illuminate the issues, and find solutions in working with other agencies and partners. Our first glance at the informed data show that on the night of January 19th, so just last month, 4,000 people who were on correctional supervision were experiencing homelessness or some housing instability in Minnesota. 4,000 people. No one should be homeless in Minnesota in January, and collectively, we can and should do better. In the packet of letters that you should have received are some incredible stories of people's experiences. I'll highlight a couple just from Emerge. It's an agency who works with large numbers of returning citizens, supporting them with career training, employment, and other kinds of supports as they resume their lives. And it speaks directly to the importance of this legislation. So Emerge shared examples of someone that we'll call Marcus. That's not his real name, but he was released from prison in February of last year, so 2020. He came to Emerge full of optimism, and his heart was set on getting a CDL and becoming a truck driver. But despite of doing everything right, he wasn't released with ID, and he was released in the middle of a pandemic. He experienced months and months of delays. So finally, just the summertime, he received his ID and registered for the training, and then the training program closed. So at some point, he also lost touch with Emerge initially. They discovered that repeated frustrations, right? Marcus had a chemical dependency relapse. He was stuck in the same place, and that's the way that he unfortunately tried to cope. But he was also fortunate that he had Emerge and medical assistance. So Emerge connected Marcus to treatment, and he's now back in recovery and finally resumed his CDL training in January. For Marcus, the simple lack of correct identification contributed to setting him back almost a full year in the reentry process. And if he hadn't been able to access health care and benefits that he needed, he could have been far worse. Emerge also wrote to highlight the importance of homelessness mitigation that's included in this bill. former Emerge employee shared their own story, right, about being released from incarceration directly into homelessness and spending the first winter out of prison living in a $600 used car. He kept warm by parking in between idle semi trucks at a rest stop, got up in the morning and showered at the Holiday before going to work. So while his release was several years ago, they do know people that they work with and work for every day who are facing that same kind of homelessness right now. So Chair and members, these stories that I shared illuminate that need for the items that are outlined in this bill. 95% of incarcerated people will eventually be released. Some are long-term with us in Department of Corrections and some are very short-term. So codify the work that DOC aims to do, stretch our ability and our capacity to do those new things, and positively impact people releasing from prisons and get on with their lives. I mean, their goal, I think, is common to ours, to go to work every day, have their own place to live, support their families, go to school, being fully invested in taxpaying citizens. So thank you, Chair and members, for hearing my testimony today. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Ms. Seifert, and thank you so much for the work that you do with our corrections systems in this regard. Just very quickly, Representative Lucero, and by the way, if you do get a chance, members, do look at the long list of excellent letters. You referenced some of those in support of the bill here, Adult Teen Challenge, American Indian OIC, Avivo, Hennepin County, Northwest Indian Community Development Center, Power to People Leadership Institute, R.S. Eden. Just excellent reads in terms of why this is important to do. It's wonderful that we have partners, if you will, with our corrections, Department of Corrections, across the state to be able to be part of a responsible and empowering way in which we can help our individuals who have paid their debts to then be able to re-enter and be productive citizens. Ms. Heifer, Representative Lucero had asked a question about protections against alterations. I don't know if you would, you might have been not have heard it, but I could certainly ask him to repeat it. But we did have this conversation last year, too, and the question had to do with that making sure that there are extensive steps so that there isn't any kind of alteration happening with what gets issued, to the individual.
I may have to tap on our government director, Safia Khan. She was also aware of the language last year and might have some more information about the security of those documents post-release.
Yep, very well. Ms. Khan, I think you are here. If you are, come forward, and the question goes to the security of the documents prior to being issued.
Chair, thank you so much, Representative Lucero. Our documents, our ID cards are secure and protected against tampering. They do have a strip in the back. We will also take extra security measures now that if this law passes, we would be giving it to people to take with them in case they don't already have an ID. The language of our bill says, they have to have, the ID has to have their full name, date of birth, and photograph. If you look at our public website, there is an offender locator where you can also, and DMV would be able to verify the person's full name, date of birth, and their picture, and the fact that they are under our supervision and that they have been released from our prison. It'll also state their sentence date and their expiration date, so that should match what is on their ID, so they can confirm that this is the same person. Your other question was around, I believe Representative Cagle had also answered that, around the undocumented folks being able to access these IDs. The purpose of the ID from DOC is for them to be able to take it to DMV to use as a secondary document. As was mentioned, they will still need a primary form of document, and they'll still need to go through that verification process as at the DMV. This is not bifurcating, or this is not going around that process. This is simply allowing them to use a DOC-issued ID as a secondary document, similar to how we use school IDs or a certified government-issued marriage certificate counts as a secondary document. So that list is a little different than the primary documents, such as passports and birth certificates, which would also be needed in conjunction with the DOC ID.
Very well, very thorough. Thank you, Ms. Khan. Representative O'Neill.
Mr. Chair, just one quick follow-up, if I may.
Yes, of course. Representative Lucero.
Just out of curiosity, is there an expiration on these? So if they're given to somebody, like our driver's license, it's good for 4 years. Since it has their name, picture, date of birth, things like that, does it expire?
Ms. Heifer or Ms. Kahn, either one.
Chair, Representative Lucero, I can take that. So the IDs right now that we issue do not have an expiration date because we don't let people take them out of our facilities. If this law passes, we will certainly redesign what that ID that they can take out with them will look like. And it'll have an expiration date, which would be the end of their sentence with us, which can also then again be verified online through our offender locator. BOP also has a similar offender locator on their website. So their IDs can also, you can also look up at the DMV that this is the same person and the expiration dates and their full names and dates of birth match the record that both BOP and DOC have.
So, Mr. Chair, thank you. I appreciate the indulgence. So then if the expiration is the end of their sentence, I mean, could in theory, if they're on probation for 15 years, could this ID be good for 15 years?
Director Kahn.
Chair, Representative Lucero, we have not designed this ID yet. At the end of the sentence can be listed on the ID. We can list an expiration date that was sooner than that. The purpose of this ID is simply for them to have something in hand that can be used as a secondary document for DMV purposes. We had expiration date listed in our language last year, and I think you talked to me about that as well. We were told by former staff at the BOP who we had worked with on this legislation that the BOP IDs do not have an expiration date on them. So it wouldn't serve all the Minnesotans who are in federal prisons here and then are returning to communities in Minnesota. So that's why that language was taken out. For our purposes, we are happy to put an expiration date to it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the bill author. I think that would be something. Presently, the current use of it doesn't require an expiration because it's not used outside the facility. But if we're going to go there, I'm not familiar with any other ID that might be, in theory, good for 20 years, 15 years, right? So I think that developing an expiration would be a good thing. And I think that that would be something that the legislature should be part of and not necessarily leaving it up to the department to come up with rules to do that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
A good point. I suspect that Representative Cagle will be more than willing to engage with you in this discussion. I do want to emphasize we're talking about a secondary document here, and so it's not unusual for secondary documents not to have expiration dates. But I hear that there is certainly a willingness to talk through that. And at one time that was part of the original approach. Very well. Thank you, Representative O'Neill, followed by Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, I actually have a drafting addition a suggestion to the author of the bill. As I was going through this bill at great length, I called the department because it's drafted oddly, and I know why now it's drafted a little bit strangely. If you look at page 2, line 2.8, paragraph D, it's an orphan. It's kind of hanging out there, but there's a good reason for that. It's just drafted strangely. So I kind of started with that. And then we started walking through the bill and talking about it at great length. And so my suggestion to the author is on page 4 and right after line 4.25, when you have the 4 things that will be reported about homelessness, my suggestion is to add a condition 5, and that is to include the offense for which they were incarcerated. And the reason I recommend that is because it would be good to know if these folks are homeless, for example, are they sex offenders who are very hard to place? That information would be very valuable. Maybe they are and maybe they aren't. I don't know because, that data is not there. So I would recommend that addition. And realizing that 4,000 people were homeless that had been discharged from DOC in January is a bit alarming. And I think they had said to me that was out of around 8,000. So in that time period, if I'm wrong, if I'm remembering that incorrectly, let me know. But I think it's really important to know which population we're talking about and what offenses that they had committed, because, some are harder to place than others. So that's my recommendation. And if they want to say anything about why D is an orphan, that's fine. But paragraph D, it's drafted strangely for good reason. But I just was, as I was reviewing the bill the last couple of days, that just looked odd to me, but I understand the why now. Thank you.
And of course, this bill will, assuming it passes here, will move through some other committees as well. I'm wondering if Director Khan, if you wish to offer any wisdom relative to the suggestion of additional language that Representative O'Neill suggests.
Chair, Representative O'Neill, thank you so much. We talked to Representative O'Neill earlier this week, and we'll certainly consider that as an amendment as this bill moves forward. And we'll work with Representative Cagle and Senator Osnick on that.
Very well. Representative Johnson, followed by Representative Raleigh, and then we'll move to a vote, members.
Chair Mariani, Representative Cagle, thank you for bringing this forward. I understand the concept of it. I am wondering if Ms. Hapert could explain the current process used to help inmates that are about to be released obtain identification at this time.
I believe that goes to Ms. Hapert. She did walk through a little bit of that, but Ms. Hapert, if you can respond.
Yes, Chair Mariani, Representative. I can tell you that the acquisition to identification actually starts the minute that someone comes in a correctional facility. So the transitions coordinators have access to DVS, and through an individual's permission, right, we always have to have their permission to be able to look at that level of information. But they start to do research to see, do they currently have photo ID on file? Do they have driver's license? What kind of requirements are needed, right, so that the person can work throughout their time in incarceration to clear whatever hurdles or barriers those are. If someone has valid identification, then it's a quite an easier process to secure those ID docs within about 6 months prior to release. We start working on that process then of either getting a birth certificate if that's needed, or if they have that photo ID on file, then we're able to process that DVS application for either ID or driver's license renewal. So transitions coordinators are actually trained, just like DVS agents through our most recent agreement this summer, and can process those IDs, and DVS staff then takes them through the triple check process that allows the person to get photo ID prior to being released. But you might have heard me say, right, it's about a six-month process to really gear up to get that identification in queue. So for folks that are really short time with us that have less than those 6 months, that's why we're really asking for that secondary form of ID. We might be able to help them get a birth certificate, which could be one form, and then the necessity for that secondary form would put them in a place when they're released to get the photo ID on their own.
Representative Johnson.
I want to thank you for Representative Mariani. Ms. Hapert, thank you for that information. Can you, since you're talking, it's mostly dealing with the short timers. Do you know what percentage of those individuals that are classified as short timers, 6, 8 months or less, or even a year or less, that do not have a current valid state ID card?
Ms. Hapert.
Representative Johnson, I do not know that number. It's kind of collectively difficult for us to get the level of data to know exactly whom. We could, we know percentages of people who come in within that short time frame, but the data on who has what kind of documentation is so individualized, it's hard to determine the number. We just know from the stories and things that we hear, right, from the community partners and the folks we've included in those letters, that it's so detrimental to not have it. So our ability to do that ID could make a big impact for folks that we just can't help on the inside.
Representative Johnson.
Representative Mariani, or Chair Mariani, I want to thank you for the information. I think that information would be good to know how many people do not have identification cards now. And also I'd like to know what the reason for that is. Is it because they just never received one or tried to obtain one beforehand? Did it expire while they were there? I have a feeling we're going to find out there's not a lot of them. I just want to make sure that that we can help them the best way we can, but I also want to make sure that our cards aren't used improperly. I'm just wondering if maybe she could give us the information that's on those cards now. Does it have the date of birth now? Does it have the just expected release date? does it have a hologram to protect it from being forged or used in improper ways?
It's time for
Representative Johnson, I believe that Safia Khan had shared with you that that ID has not yet been developed. It is something that we will have to do once we're able to pass this through to secure exactly what does that photo ID need to consist of and how can we create it in a safe way. At this point, we're just trying to look for the guidance and the approval to be able to do that.
And perhaps, you know, part of this conversation is, you know, it's one of the things that I've always sort of, you know, complained about, and not about you all or this, but about that much of our legislation where we don't always set up the opportunity for us to learn about what we've done, including, you know, expecting data, you know, where we can go find that, you know, et cetera. So I take that partly within, you know, this context, and I would trust that this committee can count on the Department of Corrections to be able to, not necessarily through legislation, but need to be able to provide information and data that can let us know whether or not we're moving in the right direction and what the impact of our legislation is. Very well, Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mariani.
Thank you. Representative
Mariani, just to finish up here.
No, yes, please, of course.
With any of our state IDs, generally, even with our driver's license, we actually by statute specify what needs to be in them, whether it's security issues and stuff like that. I would suggest that at its next stop, they look at that as an amendment requiring what's in them for security purposes. This is a, even though it's a secondary ID, this is a state-issued identification card that can be used for more, for other things than just for obtaining a different state ID card. It's an official identification card from the state of Minnesota. So we need to make sure that the security issues on it are strict, and generally that's done by statute. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Johnson. Representative Raleigh, and then after that, members will move to a vote.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. I really appreciate it. And I'm asking this question in the light of it being a secondary ID, and my question is around how verification is accomplished. So this might get a little bit technical, but I promise you I'll clarify any of the questions that I've got. So my question relates to how is cross-departmental data shared between various departments, such as the prison ID, number, or identification, being searchable by other departments, such as the DOT? The testifier, Safia Khan, stated that there's usually a data stripe on the back. And anytime I hear that there's a data stripe, that usually means that there's a UID or a unique identifier, typically going to be a number that's put into an electronic or in a magnetic stripe. So it was also mentioned that there's an offender locator. And so specifically what I'm looking for is how is this offender locator accessed? Who would have access to it? And again, the question is in light of this ID being utilized as a secondary ID, who would be able to do a lookup verification on that, and specific to the question of the offender locator, Mr. Chair?
Thank you. Representative Raleigh, Ms. Heifert, we'll start with you.
Chair Mariani, I think I might defer this to Ms. Khan, if that's possible, just because I think you have some more knowledge about that.
Very well. Director Khan.
Chair Mariani, Representative Raleigh, thank you for the question. So I'll answer your second question first, which is who will have access to the offender locator. The offender locator is public. It's on our website, so you have access to it as well. Let me just kind of back up a little bit for a second, because I think in my answers I might have shared information that wasn't as clear. Currently, DOC issues all people incarcerated an ID when they come in, right? So they have their picture on it, they have their name on it, they have it with them. That ID, they're not allowed to take outside with them because there's no purpose for that ID outside of our facilities right now. If this law passes, we would be able to give them an ID that has their full name, their date of birth, and other information that we have in our language, and they will be able to use that as a secondary document for the purposes of getting a state ID. That ID card has not been designed yet, as I mentioned earlier, and Kelly Heifert also mentioned from the DOC. So those pieces will still need to be figured out. The secondary documents that I see on the list from the DMV's website include certified government issued marriage certificates that don't have an expiration date. They don't have any pictures, et cetera, right? They also include a school ID, right? We as Department of Corrections employees have our own IDs. So it's a whole range of IDs that right now qualify as a secondary document. Beyond that, I think your other question about how these different systems speak to each other, I don't have as much information on it, but I can certainly bring that back to you, Representative Raleigh, or the full committee if there's interest. But what I do know is things like our offender's identification number, that's a unique number assigned to every individual, those are part of the offender locator, and I actually have it pulled up on my other screen right now. So we have their offender ID number, their full name, their birth date, what their current status is with us, whether they're inside a facility, and if so, which one, or if they're on supervision, then whose supervision they're under, their sentence date, their expiration date, and their agent is also listed, including their agent's email address. So that is all public information on the offender locator that we have, and then BOP has a similar locator on their website as well. I hope that answers parts of your questions, but I'll bring you back further information. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So from that testimony, what I'm hearing is there's not going to be any data privacy issues. There's not going to be any additional agreements between departments because this data is already publicly available. Last question, and it's more of a minor point. Are these magnetic stripes used for anything other than identification, such as like canteen services or doorway access or anything else like that?
Director Cohn.
Chair, Representative Raleigh, I actually don't know the answer to that, but I can bring that back to you as well. As I said, like the IDs currently that are used inside, I've seen them, but I don't know exactly what they're used for. So,
Representative Raleigh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm satisfied.
Very well. Thank you, Representative Raleigh, for your questions. Representative Cagle. I think we're ready to move. If you have just very brief final thoughts, then we'll move to a vote.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And I also want to just highlight the point that Representative O'Neill brought up, that I was really shocked when I saw some of those statistics about unsheltered homelessness or homelessness for people leaving incarceration. And I think the thing that shocked me the most is where people are released into homelessness. And, you know, you'd think that it was kind of concentrated around the metro area, but really that's not the case. One of the counties that had the highest rate of homelessness upon leaving incarceration was Clay County. And so I think this is a really key piece to this legislation. And I think, you know, our job is to make sure that we're setting people up for success. And I think that this bill really takes a big step forward in making sure that, you know, all Minnesotans can be successful. So thank you, members. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Cagle, for your careful work in working this bill, constructing it, and being able to be part of a good, strong, bipartisan effort in addressing this issue. With that, the chair renews his motion that House File 553, as amended, is referred to the Transportation Committee. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Mariani.
Aye.
Chair Mariani, aye. Vice Chair Frazier.
Aye.
Vice Chair Frazier, aye. Representative Johnson.
Aye.
Representative Johnson, aye. Representative Edelson.
Aye.
Representative Edelson, aye. Representative Feist?
Aye.
Representative Feist, aye. Representative Grossel, excused. Representative Hollins?
Aye.
Representative Hollins, aye. Representative Hewitt?
Aye.
Representative Hewitt, aye. Representative Cleburne?
Aye.
Representative Cleburne, aye. Representative Long?
Aye.
Representative Long, aye. Representative Lucero?
No.
Representative Lucero, nay. Representative Mueller?
Mueller votes yes.
Representative Mueller, aye. Representative Novotny?
Novotny, yes.
Representative Novotny, aye. Representative O'Neill?
O'Neill, aye.
Representative O'Neill, aye. Representative Pinto? Excused. Representative Poston?
Poston, aye.
Representative Poston, aye. Representative Raleigh?
Raleigh, aye.
Representative Raleigh, aye. Representative Vang?
Aye.
Representative Vang, aye. Representative Zhang?
Aye.
Representative Zhang, aye.
Lucero changes from no to yes. I'm sorry I got confused with a bill listening to in commerce. Sorry.
It's noted. Thank you. That concludes roll call with 17 ayes and one and two excused.
Very well. Members, with a vote of 17 ayes and two excused, House File 553 as amended is referred to the Committee on Transportation.
Thank you, members.
Thank you again, Representative Cagle. Representative Long has House File 1267. Representative Long moves to refer House File 1267 to the Ways and Means Committee. Representative Long, your bill is before us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That is my motion. Every incarcerated person deserves to receive appropriate health care and safe conditions, but unfortunately, we know that is not the case in Minnesota today. Thanks to the investigative reporting of CARE 11's Cruel and Unusual series and others, we've heard the heartbreaking stories of the conditions in some of our jails. Tragically, some have died while in state custody, over 50 since 2015. You will hear two of those stories today. Brett Huber Sr., the father of Brett Huber Jr., and Del Shea Perry, the mother of Hardell Sherrell. Nationally, suicides account for 31% of jail deaths, but in Minnesota, we have double the national average. Suicides account for 60% of deaths in our jails. The Department of Corrections has the authority to license correctional facilities and to set minimum standards, but this authority has not been updated in 50 years. It is confusing, vague, and has little teeth. The use of force statute covering our correctional facilities has not changed since 1905. This bill that we're hearing today would do three main things. It would update the minimum standards for licensed facilities to reflect current best practices. It would increase transparency for detention facilities in Minnesota, and it would ensure accountability for violations of minimum standards by licensed facilities. We've also heard public concern about the use of jails to board Department of Correction inmates for space constraints. And while this bill may not go as far as some would prefer, it does create transparency in these practices, requiring reporting, including reporting of demographic data. I commend Commissioner Schell for owning the department's role, listening to those impacted, and working with the Sheriff's Association and community organizations on this piece of legislation. I stand willing to engage with community members in this committee to make sure we get this difficult problem right. And I do have an author's amendment, Mr. Chair, if you'd like to take that now.
Very well. Representative Long, up to you. If you want to move your author's amendment, we can do that right now. Absolutely.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The author's amendment would just make some technical changes, and it would improve also the language on chokeholds in the bill with the improved definition, would provide some more flexibility on limited license suspension, would clarify the notification timeline for deaths in jails, and would make clear that licenses will be suspended in circumstances where there's an imminent risk of harm or life-threatening injury. So it's to get the bill in the shape the author would like.
Well, Representative Law, why don't we hold off on your author's amendment and hear testimony first?
Okay.
And then we can come back to that, if that's okay with you.
Thank you, Chair.
Representative Rowling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If I could ask the chair to let us know which amendment, when it's time to introduce the amendments, because we've got several amendments before us, and I want to keep track of them as we're looking at each of the amendments, Mr. Chair.
You bet. Will do. With that, why don't we move to the testifier portion of the bill presentation. Representative Long.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We'll first hear from the Department of Corrections. Is Amy Lorisella.
Very well. Welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the record and give us your testimony.
Thank you, Chair and members. Good morning. My name is Amy Lorisella. I'm a specialist in the Government and External Relations Unit for the Department of Corrections. I facilitated the drafting of this bill with our experts and stakeholders. I'm a civil and human rights attorney with over 10 years of policy development, systems audits, and investigative experience, both domestically and internationally. And I've worked with incarcerated persons, as well as people who've experienced violence, and I'm grateful to be here with you today. To run through the bill just quickly, I'm going to try to share my screen so that we can kind of follow along together. Let me just get that pulled up for you. Can you all see this?
Yes.
Great. Okay, excellent. So what we're doing here is amending Minnesota Statute 241.021, which is a statute on our correctional licensing authority. And the first section addresses a couple of things. The first thing that it does is really just ensure that there are very specific categories where the department is going to be providing guidance to licensed facilities on what those minimum standards should be. It's including things like mental health, medication administration, when information needs to be shared with medical personnel about the folks who are incarcerated in these facilities, and when they need to facilitate medical assessment, including things such as policy training, things like death review, updating the minimum standards on things that, as of now, you know, have become sort of common practice and are considered best practices nationally. Next, what it does is it clarifies the licensing expiration date. It's a two-year license. We don't change that, but it just confirms that once that two-year period ends, if that license has not been renewed, it is expired. And then scrolling down, I know I'm going a little quickly, but hopefully folks have had a chance to review the bill as well. The other thing that it does is it clarifies that it shortens the time frame for reporting when in-custody deaths happen. Right now, it's a 10-year time, a 10-day time period and rule, and it's going to update that to be a 24-hour time period. And then scrolling down here are the strikeout language that you're going to see. This is just the rest of the current statute, where no changes were made. So we're moving this section of strikeout language is just being reorganized again, because the statute is so old. It was all kind of contained in one subdivision. And so we've broken it out to make it a little more understandable and wieldy. So subdivision section 2 of the bill creates a new subdivision, subdivision 1A. And what this does is it creates and it sort of codifies what's already occurring in our rule and what we've been doing in practice by issuing correction orders and conditional licensure orders. So what this section of the bill does is it just updates that very old language, and it clarifies the way that the commissioner may act, not when revoking a license, but how they can support changes to ensure that minimum standards are being met. It's sort of what we view as the technical assistance portion of our licensing authority. And then it also authorizes the commissioner to lift those conditional licensure orders or correction orders once satisfactory progress is being made towards that minimum standards and compliance with those. Section 3, pardon me while I scroll again. Section 3, this is the relocated area that I talked about above. This has to do with our revocation authority that already is in statute. So it relocates it, and really what it does is it defines a very clear process for revocation, which is not currently in law, and it affords facilities an opportunity to engage, provide response, and participate. Scrolling on. Okay, subdivision 1C here, this is section 4. This is new statutory authority that we were proposing, and it allows the Department of Corrections to temporarily and immediately suspend a license only if there is an imminent risk of life-threatening harm or serious physical injury to either the persons confined or incarcerated in the facility or staff, law enforcement, who oftentimes have to go in, visitors, or the public. And then here, section 5 is establishing a process for licensed facilities to request reconsideration and appeal those department licensing actions that are envisioned in the statute. And then section 6, this is a section of the statute where we establish some annual reporting requirements for the Department of Corrections to the legislature. It's going to include things like information on the number of individuals who have died in custody in licensed and state correctional facilities, information on death review results should there have been policy changes that were implemented afterwards, information on uses of force inside correctional facilities, information on individuals committed to the custody of the Department of Corrections but who are housed outside of DOC facilities. And then the last one here is only applies to the Department of Corrections, but summary data on complaints and discipline for staff that have been filed. Section 7, this is just relocating the definition. We have not changed the definition of correctional facility. We left that alone. We just had to reorganize it. Section 8, right here, this is an area where we're requiring all correctional facilities to provide a release of information form right away at intake for the release of information on somebody's health condition in the event that they become incapacitated. It does not require the individual to sign it, but it just is an opportunity for them to designate somebody should they want to. And then Section 9 here is establishing death review teams and requiring correctional facilities to create a process. It does articulate that there are certain individuals that should be involved. A mental health expert, to the extent that it's appropriate, definitely will need a medical an expert who can provide information on medical services. And what this does is it doesn't actually require that the review itself be shared with the Department of Corrections, but it requires that any changes made to policy or practice following the review be shared with the department. And then last here, we have Section 10. This is an area of statute that has was originated at least as old as over 100 years ago, and it has not been substantially updated since then. There have been some limited changes, but overall, you know, this is our statute that authorizes use of force. And what it does is what we're looking to do is amend that correctional officer discipline use of force statute to prohibit certain things that are no longer best practice in terms of restraints, including the chokeholds, and then defining what deadly force is and when it's justified. And then the last section of it just creates a duty to report when staff observe either neglect or an excessive use of force in a facility. That concludes the summary of House File 1267, and I'm happy to stick around for questions when it's time.
Very well. Thank you, Ms. Larasella, for walkthrough of the bill. Representative Long.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Next, we'll hear from Commissioner Schnell.
Commissioner Schnell, welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, committee members. Again, it's a pleasure to be with you. I'm going to make my comments very brief because I think the folks that you hear after me are going to be important to hear from. Members, this is a high priority matter, and I think you will hear why in the upcoming testimony. If you've had a chance to see any of the CARE 11 expose, I think it elevates this. I think certainly the governor has had an opportunity to meet with many of these family members. For him, was compelling. I want to thank the family members who are going to be here, who are with us today and watching this very closely. A couple of them you're going to hear from immediately after me. We've heard from family members, members that this bill does not go far enough. And I understand that as well. I recognize that that there is more work to be done, that this should be an area of importance, but we believe this is a much needed step in the right direction. And I will assure you that this will not be the end of this conversation going forward, but an important first step. I wanna also say thank you to the Sheriff's Association who provided four sheriffs from across the state and agencies big and large and small, who really represented their members in helping us craft and develop the language before you today. We have heard from the executive director, Mr. Hutton, that the Sheriff's Association is generally supportive of the language here. And of course, the committee has a number of amendments before it today. And we understand that this bill may look different as it goes through this process. And we are committed to engaging with any of the members and anyone who really has concerns that we can address as we go forward. I just want to say, as the agency responsible for the regulatory role provided to us and required of us by the legislature, that I take this as a personal area of a deep concern. Many of these concerns have been longstanding, and it is a due time, and shouldn't have been based upon tragedy, but that is where we find ourselves, that we address this. And I will tell you that I am wholly committed to that. I will also say that as we look at the broader, and I know we will be talking about the budget elements of this in the future, but there is in the OLA audit, as you will recall, hearing some weeks ago now, that there was some recommendations around the use of and having inspections occur. And we believe that having inspections occur is one of the ways that we do this, making sure that there's consistency and practice across our correctional facilities in the state. And we intend to have some additional inspections resources to be able to do these important and critical standards inspections in our facilities as well. I also want to point out that if you watch the series, that there was concerns raised about medical provision and contract services that are available. We share that concern. We know that there is lots of attention around this across our state, and we've been watching this very closely because ultimately that is outside of the DOC's scope of authority, and that really falls under the contract medical providers, a licensed medical or physician who does that, which then falls under the Board of Medical Practice. So there is some differences in how some of this stuff comes together, but we look to see ways to better coordinate. I can't stress enough, members, that this is a crisis situation. I think the folks you hear from immediately after me will make that clear. And with that, Mr. Chair, I would like to turn this over to Mr. Huber, who will testify as a person who's been impacted and lost a son, and then after that we'll be happy to answer questions.
Well, thank you, Commissioner. Mr. Huber, welcome to our committee. Thank you for being with us here today. Please state your name for the record and give us your testimony, please, sir.
Thank you, Chairman Mariani, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Brett Warner Huber Sr. I am the father of Brett Warner Huber Jr., my deceased son. I'm also a son, a father, a husband, a granddad, and a Heartlander. I have roots in Minnesota, where my folks live in Murray County on Lake Sarah. I've just purchased land in the area and plan to retire here in Minnesota. I do that because this is a state of good people. This is a state of neighbors that care about neighbors. It's a state of people that are quick to wave, quick with a smile, quick to help when needed, and quick to stay out of your business when not needed. So I appreciate this area. I appreciate the people of this area, and I appreciate all of your service. So a little bit about my background. I've been in politics in Alaska for off and on for nearly 30 years. I served both as chief of staff in the Alaska State Senate to a number of individuals and the administrative branch, where my last post was director of policy and communications for the governor. This isn't about me today, it's about Brett. Brett Jr. was a beautiful young man. He was a loving family member. He was a Christian, both in belief and in practice and in action. That young man had a super intellect and was an amazing physical specimen. He was a caring kid that lived his life by the motto he loved, which was be quick to love and slow to judge. I'm here for Brett today and for the rest of my family, not because any of us can affect his horrific outcome, but because he would want to help ensure that no other human beings or their families find themselves in this same situation. I have to tell you that many people, and understandably, retreat from a situation like this and grieve. I found myself in that same situation after this first occurred, but then understood that it's important for people not to just retreat and grieve, but also dig into the facts and share the stories and raise public awareness. And I appreciate the opportunity to help do that today. Brett was an achiever. He was a varsity wrestler while he was still in junior high. He was a master scuba diver at age 11. He was an emergency first responder and a lifeguard as he was a teen. He was a bright and witty kid. But my son was also an addict, and his drug of choice is MDMA. Brett was not just an addict, he was dual diagnosed. His addiction, as well as serious anxiety and depression issues. Those came and went, and Brett went through that horrible cycle of treatment, recovery, and relapse. That's difficult for families, difficult for all involved, but the most difficult for the individual that finds themselves in that circumstance. Brett's professional career included the Alaska Legislature, where he began as a Senate page. He went on to staff for the co-chairs of the House Finance Committee for two sessions. He then decided that he wanted to try a little bit bigger pond and was hired and went to work for U.S. Senator Dan Sullivan in Washington, D.C. I don't tell you that to exalt Brett. I tell you that to emphasize that no one is immune from this situation. No one is immune from the scourge of what drugs and mental illness can do to an individual and to a family. No one. Brett, I appreciate you letting me refer to my notes today.
Absolutely.
The problems to address are absolutely in a crisis situation. I couldn't agree more. We all know family members, friends, neighbors who suffer or have suffered from an addiction or a mental illness. It is not the, it's commonplace, right? That's the society that we live in. That's the difficult times that we live in. So on March 18th, 2017, my son suffered a psychotic break just days before he was working in the United States Senate. He left his position, was on my way to my parents' house in Southwest Minnesota when he hooked up with a girl that he knew in the cities and apparently went on one last binge. He was taken by her to the hospital in Alexandria. His psychotic break led him to believe that he was trying to be killed, that his life was in danger. He fled, stole two vehicles, and was apprehended on top of a semi-trailer on I-94. If you haven't seen the footage, it is difficult, disturbing, horrific in nature, but speaks clearly to anybody that has watched it, including over the 1 million views on the internet, that this young man was not in his right mind. After being apprehended, he was taken to Sauk Center Hospital, where his irrational fears and behavior continued to be present. During that time and before any help was being able to be provided, the Todd County officers arrested Brett and took him to Todd County Jail, where he remained without psychiatric evaluation or any mental health treatment until he hanged himself on his cell on June 9th of that year. Let me emphasize that again. Without a psychiatric evaluation, although it was court ordered, without any mental health treatment from March to June. There were multiple off-roads available to save my son's life. At the time, I didn't know that. At the time, I had no idea exactly what was happening within that facility. That's one of the issues that I hope is addressed and could be addressed further by this bill, with the ability to let a family member understand what's going on and be an advocate, especially when somebody's having mental health situations. I talked to the jail repeatedly. I took a leave of absence from my position, came down to my folks' house, presented myself every opportunity I had to visit my son, which was 20 minutes, 2 days a week, through the glass, and tried my best to keep his spirits up, to level him off, to let him know that help was on the way, to let him know that he was in a safe place and that the people there were caring for him. I find after the fact that it could not have been more wrong. There were multiple incidents, hallucinations, visual hallucinations, auditory hallucinations, suicidal ideations, suicidal attempts. Yet all of those things took place and still no mental health evaluation and no mental health treatment. At the same time, I was being told by jail administrators that your son's doing fine. We've got him. We're taking good care of the boy. Your son's doing fine. Could not have been further from the truth. So I was after Brett's incident. That's how it was described to me when they called me. Your son has had an incident. What's wrong? Is he okay? That's all we can tell you. So after discovering what that incident was and that my son was lying on the floor of his jail cell for 10 minutes, deprived of oxygen, while well checks were being falsified and nobody was monitoring the camera, I immediately asked for all of the information and all of the evidence. And I received nothing from Todd County, not a callback, not a bit of information, nothing. So as often is the case, the only way to get to the bottom of something is to litigate. We are not a litigious family. It's the last thing that we wanted to do, but it is the one thing that we had to do to learn the truth. So I turn your attention to case number 018-CV-0237-SRN-LIB, which was filed in the U.S. District Court on August 8th of 2018. Today's not about retrying the case. I'd just like you all to take a look at that if you have an opportunity, because it is a horrific example of how the current laws and policies are failing, not just the victims, but the general public. I applaud you all for stepping up and serving the public in the capacities that you've chosen. It is not a small responsibility. I understand that. It oftentimes comes with long hours and little reward. I understand that as well. I have a deep respect for law enforcement. I have law enforcement in my family. Part of my purview within the governor's office was the Department of Corrections, Department of Public Safety, and Department of Law for the state of Alaska. I understand that there are delicate balances and that there are difficulties in dealing with these situations. But Minnesota and your county jails are just so far behind the curve that it's truly, to me, it's just abominable. And I appreciate Representative Long for bringing this bill forward and for y'all for hearing the bill today. So this pattern of misconduct, I had no idea. A young man died in the facility a month before my son did. Had no idea. Two jail inspections were performed in the years before my son's death, where well checks were being falsified or not being conducted, where all of the problems that were identified that led to Brett's demise were identified previously, yet nothing was done about it. This is a small first step. I agree with the commissioner. I think there's a lot of things that the commissioner can do administratively to help in this situation as well. And I look forward to seeing that happen. I hear the words, but I'm a trust and verify guy. So I'll be glad to be involved in this process as we continue through the process. So this was not just a decision made by a kid that we thought was okay. My wife is the deputy commissioner of the Department of Corrections in Alaska. My daughter is a clinician in the Ventura County Jail. This was a family decision. My 84-year-old father went and visited Brett in jail. We all came up to the determination that he needed this psychiatric evaluation, he needed this mental health help, and the safest place for our son was to leave him in the Todd County facility. We could have not possibly been more wrong, and I could not possibly be more disappointed in the actions that led up to his death and the actions of the other jails that have just made these statistics untenable. 50 deaths between 2000 and 2015, according to your own legislative audit, and 50 deaths following that, twice the national average in suicide rate. I don't blame any one individual, but I think as a society, we have to do better. As a group of individuals, we have to do better. These are people that are at their lowest point, at their most vulnerable point. I said before, my son was a Christian. He, like I, believed that we were all made in God's image. And the time that the people need the help the most is the time that we ought to be there for them. That is not the case. It has proven not to be the case. I no longer have a son. My son and daughter no longer have a brother. My 87 and 82-year-old parents are still suffering daily from his loss. We can't do anything about Brett, but I know Brett would want to say this to you. Please, God, please do what is within your power to make things better. If it's a small sequential step, be that as it may, take that step. 50 years of archaic system that is failing has to be addressed. So thank you again for the opportunity to testify. I'll be happy to participate with this bill or other issues as it goes through the process. I have nothing more important right now than to make sure that no other young man or no other family goes through the same type of horror that way too many families have already. And thank you for your time today.
Thank you, Mr. Huber, for being with us today and for sharing your son's story and your family's story with us. We are humbled by it. Your love and your pride in your son is pretty clear. And I think what should be clear to all of us is that Brett deserved better. He deserved humanity. Frankly, that he should be with us today. And so the work before us is to make law so that we can make that happen for others so that we don't have the loss of another beloved, and that we have a humanity-centered correction system. Thank you, Mr. Huber.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee.
Members, next we will hear from Dalshay Perry. If you can come forward, we are privileged and humbled to have you with us as well today. Please give us your name and please give us your name today. Welcome.
Good morning, good morning, Representative Mariani, Representative Frazier, Representative Johnson, and the committee members. Thank you for giving me this opportunity to come before you today to share with you what happened to my son. And I certainly want to thank God for giving me the strength, because this is by far one of the hardest things I've ever had to endure. My heart also goes out to the Huber family as well. I certainly know your pain. My name is Dalshay Perry. I am the mother of Hardell Sherrill, who died in the Beltrami County Jail in September of 2018. While in custody, he suffered tremendously. He was just 27 years of age, leaves behind three little girls who don't have a father. And explaining to them what happened has been horrific and very hard for me to do. As I said, Hardell was my only child. And I just ask if any of you are listening today are parents of children, of either an only child or children. I just ask you to just put yourself in my shoes for a minute. Hardell's death was senseless, unnecessary, and completely preventable. While in custody, he developed GBS, Guillain-Barré syndrome, which is a neurological disorder that causes paralysis. Hardell spent the last few days of his life on a jail floor in unimaginable agony and pain. He couldn't eat or drink. He could not use his hands or legs. He couldn't use the toilet. He couldn't call his family for help. And mind you, he walked into the Beltrami County Jail just fine. He was in soiled urine and feces filled with pens and completely helpless. There was even a point where he was left to stay on a jail cell floor for nearly 8 hours. The paralysis slowly spread through his body and attached his respiratory organs. He could no longer swallow or breathe. This is how my son spent his final days of life, while everyone just stood by and watched. Numerous correctional officers and medical staff watched Hardell die a slow and painful death. They all thought he was faking it. Unfortunately, he was slowly dying right before their very eyes. And they just left him there on a cold jail cell floor, crying out for help for days, not minutes, days, until he took his last breath. What happened to my son sounds like a horror story from a third world country. But no, it happened right here in the United States of America. The most powerful, richest, most prosperous country in the world, where we have access to the best medical care and unlimited resources, but yet he was denied them all. We know almost to a certainty that Hardell would have recovered from his condition if he were hospitalized instead of being left to fend for himself on the jail floor. And again, let me remind you, there were times that he was left on the jail cell floor for 8 hours. But the people in charge of his care thought of him as less than human, that he didn't deserve to have a chance to return to his family and friends, that he didn't deserve even the basic of medical care. He was not just my son, but he was my best friend. He was my everything outside of God. We did everything together. And when he died, a piece of me died too. He was a nephew. He was a cousin. He was a friend to many in our lives have been forever changed. I have been traumatized by seeing the way that he was treated and suffered for days. So I ask you why this bill must pass. Because laws haven't changed in over 100 years, and jail reform is needed to help prevent this from happening again to someone else's son or daughter. This bill must be made about saving lives and preventing senseless deaths. Cardell was not the first nor the last to die in Beltrami County Jail. I don't know if you remember Bruce Lundmark. Well, he got sick there, and instead of taking him to the hospital, they quickly shipped him off to another county jail, where during booking, he died. He didn't even get to get booked in. He died during booking. That's horrific. It's unacceptable. And the reason I have been fighting the way that I have been fighting is when I've learned about all the suspicious deaths in Beltrami County Jail. And I knew that I had to do something. And this is the something that I do. My brother, Traren Cruz, and many of my other family and friends have been helping me to go out and protest and rally and tell what happened. The truth is what we've been fighting for them to understand that they didn't just take away an inmate. He wasn't just another inmate. He was my son, my only child. My brother has helped me tremendously, to continue this fight. Minnesota County jails are so unregulated. People are dying. And until Hardell's death and everything that has happened, no one noticed. Or if they did, it seemed that they didn't care because it wasn't affecting them and their son or daughter. My goal with getting this bill passed into law is to save lives and allow those incarcerated to be able to pay their debt to society without being tormented, tortured, mistreated, or neglected like my son. I'm not asking for any special treatment for jail inmates, no. And I'm not asking for any special accommodations. All I'm asking is that the county jail treats people as human beings. It's a basic minimum standard to make sure that people stop dying senselessly. So I ask you to name this bill in honor of my son as a small token of honor for his girls. We wouldn't be here today asking that this bill be put in my son's name had it not been for all the hard work that myself and Traren and so many others have rallied and protested and gone before the governor and other places. If we had done what we had done to bring this to your attention today, again, it's left behind a heartbroken mama and three dead little girls. And it would be the world to us to have this bill in his name. I thank you so much for it.
Thank you, Ms. Perry, for being with us today. Our hearts are broken with you. And as I shared with Mr. Huber, your son should still be with us today. He deserved way better. He deserved nothing short of humanity. It's not, in my opinion, that complicated. We will work with you and the other families to make sure that our laws reflect the painful learning that should not have been learned so that other families do not have to endure what you are enduring. We will work together for that. And as we do that, please accept our sincere love and wishes for you and your family for some peace and some healing as you go forward. Thank you so much for being with us here today.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Mariani and the committee. God bless you all.
God bless you, ma'am. I think that's what we have for testifiers, Representative Long. There are several amendments before us. I do see Representative Frazier's hand is up, and so I'll call on him at this point.
Thank you, Chair Mariani. You covered much of, you touched on some of the things I wanted to say. Ms. Nielsen, thank you for sharing your story. Thank you for bringing that and bringing your son into this conversation. And his life won't be in vain. The one-on-one questions I wanted to ask directly to Commissioner Schnell is if there's any power you have in your authority as an executive to disrupt or change the manner in which we're using our jails to prevent situations like this from happening in the future. I'm just asking, find it, have your people look into that and do everything you can. Because this story sounds like it could have been prevented. We didn't have to hear this story today. Ms. Nielsen, again, thank you for bringing it, and we'll do everything we can to make sure this doesn't happen again. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Representative Frazier. Commissioner Schell.
Mr. Chair, Representative Frazier, the name, just so you know, the name on the screen is actually one of a staff here because she's using a computer at our office. So Ms. Perry is in a different room, so she needed access to a computer. So she's actually here. Your point is well taken, and I will tell you that we'll look at this is all grounded in rulemaking, and we have rulemaking authority. And I think with Mr. Huber or Ms. Perry's involvement and other families who've been impacted, we can, I believe, exercise more authority through that rulemaking process and take action. This bill, however, will also put really some important guardrails in place.
Very well. Thank you, Commissioner Schnell. Members, we're going to move on to the amendments. To Representative Raleigh's earlier question, it will be the chair's intent to take up the A1 amendment followed by the A5 amendment. I believe there are amendments to that amendment. I'll be moving on to the 7, 2, and 4 after that. It is unusual for a chair to share the order of the amendments. However, I think the specialness of this bill meets the request of our colleagues so that folks can prepare themselves. So with that, members, the chair will move the A1 amendment. It's a pretty simple amendment. It names the Act, the Hardell-Sherrill Act. This comes as a request from the family itself. We heard that request a few moments ago. And let me just say that probably just the obvious that there are moments when we do this, when we ascribe a name to a law in order to emphasize the unique moment in our collective history as a people that call us as lawmakers to act. It's one way in which we honor both the individual that's impacted, but also through that person recognize the many individuals impacted. It's our way of saying as legislators that we see their reality, that we see the tragedy that occurred in this case, that we see a tragedy and that it occurred and that we are committed to changing that, so much so that we will take that special step of giving the law a name. And, you know, at the end, members, for me, and I suspect for all of us here, it's about affirming the importance of laws to reflect our common humanity. Laws without humanity are, in my opinion, not laws. They're rules and regulations. The law is, in my opinion, meant to be a manifestation or reflection of our common humanity. So with that, members, the Chair moves the A1 amendment. Discussion. Hearing no discussion, the clerk will take the roll on the amendment.
Chair Mariani.
Aye.
Chair Mariani, we can do a roll call if you wish.
Representative Johnson.
Or not a roll call, a voice vote.
If that's fine with you, we can do that, certainly. Thank you, Representative Johnson. All in favor of adopting the A1 amendment, please say aye.
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 Aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails, and the A1 amendment is adopted. Next, we have the A5 amendment, and that is the author's amendment, Representative Long. Representative Long moves the A5 amendment. There are amendments to the amendment, but the Representative Long, if you can get us started.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I described the A5 earlier. This is the author's amendment, and there is an A8 amendment to the A5 amendment that I would like to move.
Very well. Representative Long moves. Actually, I have Representative Holland's name.
Pardon me. That is Representative Holland's amendment. Okay. I will. Thank you. I got confused.
No, very well. So let's get to the order. Representative Long moves the A5 amendment, and Representative Hollins is moving to amend the A5 amendment with the A8 amendment. The A8 amendment is before us. Representative Hollins, to your amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Long. This is a pretty simple amendment. It just adds the term prone restraint, which is restraining someone so they're face down, to the list of prohibited uses of force.
Very well. Thank you, Representative Hollins. Discussion, Representative Long.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would be happy to support Representative Hollins' amendment, and I appreciate her bringing it.
Very well. Any further discussion? All right. Representative
Hollins is fine.
I'm sorry, Representative Johnson?
A voice vote is fine on this.
Very well. Thank you, Representative Johnson. All in favor of the A8 amendment to the A5 amendment, please signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails, and the A5 amendment is adopted, or rather amended, with the A8 amendment. There is another amendment to the amendment, I believe, unless I've got confused. I might have a... I don't think there is.
I don't believe so, Mr. Chair.
Very well. Okay. Members, discussion on the A5 amendment as amended. Representative Johnson, should we do a roll?
The voice vote is fine.
Very well. Thank you, Representative Johnson. All in favor of the A5 amendment as amended, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. The A5 amendment is adopted. Next, we have the A7 amendment. The Representative Hollins, I believe that's your amendment.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Thank you so much. I believe this would be considered a friendly amendment. What this aims to do is to incorporate some of the recommendations that were created in the past. So in 2016, the Office of Legislative Auditor published a report on mental health care standards in jails with a number of concerns and urgent issues to be addressed. They found that there are no procedures for following up with people who screen positive when they look at mental illness in their booking assessments. The OLA recommended policies and procedures for suicide prevention, well checks, solitary confinement, and a number of other things. And in 2018, a group of sheriff's advocates and the DOC developed language to address some of these critical issues, but the rules were never promulgated. So it's been 5 years since the OLA's report, and this bill has been drafted in response to continued findings that the standards and procedures in Minnesota jails are incredibly inadequate to keep Minnesotans with mental illness safe. So this amendment would add minimum licensing standards for jails and addresses the recommendations on the 2016 OLA report to prevent suicides and ensure that people get mental health care that they need. It further increases accountability for the enforcement of standards by requiring the department to post on their website when facilities are disciplined for violations, and it shortens the timeline so that violations are addressed as quickly as possible. And it also, along with other important data collection in the bill, the amendment will require the department to report the number of people who were put in solitary confinement or segregation and how many people attempted suicide, how many people were transported out of the jail for medical care. And that is what the amendment does. I think it's an important amendment to try to bring in some of those recommendations that were made 5 years ago, and I hope that Representative Long supports it.
Well, thank you, Representative Hollins. So just to be clear on the record, Representative Hollins moves the A7 amendment. We certainly did hear testimony from Mr. Huber on mental health issues and huge gaps and flaws in his son's experience. Representative Long.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Hollins. I do support the amendment. I believe it improves the bill and adds some specificity to the mental health standards.
Very well. Discussion, Representative Raleigh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To Representative Hollins, did you work with NAMI on these standards?
Representative Hollins.
Sorry, muted. I'm muted. Yes, Representative Raleigh, I did.
Excellent. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And boy, I think we've got a delay. Sorry about that, Mr. Chair. Didn't mean to speak over you. Representative Hollins, with the NAMI standards, one of the things I'm not seeing in here, and this might just be a clarification, with the testimony we heard previously that there were, and I'm using air quotes, there were checks that were done on some of the other inmates. Are there any standards that NAMI shared with you on frequency or anything else that we can enter into the testimony as guidance for later on? Mr. Chair.
Representative Hollins.
I apologize. My internet must be going out. I couldn't make out anything that Representative Raleigh said.
Let's give it another try. Representative Raleigh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, my system is showing that your bars are all in the red. So I'll try again. With the NAMI recommendations and with the testimony that we've heard today that well checks were being performed, in order to enter this into the record, did NAMI have any recommendations on frequency for any checks or any other recommendations in order to make sure that the health and welfare is being well taken care of, not just checking a box saying we did it?
Representative Hollins.
Okay, thank you so much. That is an excellent question. May I defer to the NAMI representative, Elliot Boutet, who's online as well?
And I was just looking to see if there was someone here. I do see Elliot there. Mr. Boutet, if you're willing to come forward and help us answer Representative Raleigh's good question, we'd appreciate it.
Good. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Raleigh, I'm Elliot Boutai, the Criminal Justice Coordinator at NAMI Minnesota. And I actually would need to get back on a specific time frame, but the OLA report is, I think, enlightening about that. And also just some of the policies, I think the findings were that the well checks weren't even being done according to the current DOC policy. So that is, but I believe it maybe Commissioner Schnell might say, I think it's something like 15 minutes or half an hour is the current policy. And but I would need to double check on the national standards.
Commissioner Schnell, any you could offer in this conversation?
Yes, Mr. Chair and Representative Raleigh, I think there are standards, I think, in many of these cases, but I think Mr. Huber referenced was the fact that the checks were noted that they had taken place, but in fact that they had not taken place in the manner prescribed by the current standard, which I believe is a largely a national standard that would be reviewed as part of this. But we would make sure that I believe it is 15 minutes at present when people are in a watch and watch standards are present. The challenge we're finding is many times it is not occurring as prescribed.
Thank you. Commissioner Representative Raleigh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate that. And I think getting this testimony on the record will absolutely enhance and help this bill.
I concur, Representative Rowley, and I do think also that your further digging in terms of making sure that whatever we legislate is not meant to just be a check-the-box exercise, but that there is a force of will and commitment and humanity behind it is critically important. So thank you for bringing that up, sir.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Mr. Boutte.
The OLA report does say the National Commission on Correctional Healthcare Standard for inmates who are potentially suicidal is every 15 minutes.
Okay, very well. Thank you. I appreciate you checking on that. Senator Bolio.
Mr. Chair, so this amendment greatly expands the bill, which I'm not necessarily opposed to, but I would like to know what the Sheriff Association has to say and yeah, so I just want to know if there's any opposition to this amendment because it is pretty expansive. It's probably a good amendment, but I'd like to hear a little more testimony because it's pretty meaty.
I don't believe we have anyone here from the sheriff, so I'm looking. If there is, please pipe in. I do know that the commissioner did share earlier that there were, you know, careful work being done and that the bill, you know, moved per interactions with several stakeholders, including the sheriffs. So I think it's perfectly reasonable for you to ask that question, Representative O'Neill. I don't see anyone here that can answer your question from that community, however.
Commissioner Schnell has something.
Very well. Commissioner Schnell.
Mr. Chair, Representative O'Neill, I would just say that we have talked to them about some of the recommendations that were coming forth. We did not get into the details of these specific requirements. There was interest by the sheriffs of making sure that NAMI's voice was here, as they are the state's standard bearer around bringing these issues forward and lifting up the importance of them. So we will certainly circle back with them, but we did talk about a number of these things that NAMI had brought forward by way of recommendations. And I would also add that many of these things were things that OLA really had addressed and touched on before. And what we're doing, I think, as Representative Hollins represented, is really moving this forward in a statutory fashion.
Representative Hollins, I'm recalling earlier your testimony. I don't know if this goes to this point. You certainly cannot speak on behalf of the sheriffs, but you did indicate that language before us in this amendment includes as its source procedures that the Sheriff's Association had developed, but that rules were never promulgated. So I'm wondering if you... if there's anything there relative to Representative O'Neill's question, short of course, not you can't speak on behalf of them. But is there anything there relative to that?
That's correct. I appreciate Representative O'Neill's concerns. I think they're very valid. Obviously, I wasn't there in 2018 when this group got together to create some of these rules and develop the language around it. But my understanding from NAMI, who was there, is that the language of this amendment comes directly out of those stakeholder engagements. And I guess I would look to NAMI's representative, Elliot, to see if he has anything to add to this conversation.
Mr. Butai.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. In 2018, our executive director, Sue Afterholden, was part of a group, and they had developed language, and we had actually worked with the former director of inspections and enforcement, and we had it drafted, and we were in the final kind of phases of getting approval with the sheriffs and just tweaking it. So we do even have existing like rule language that we had agreed to before, but they just did not get promulgated.
Very well. I suspect, and I would certainly hope that ongoing conversations continue with all stakeholders, including with our sheriffs.
Chair Mariani.
Representative Johnson.
I do believe that the Sheriff's Association has joined this call. Maybe we can get to
the manager. Sheriff Hutton there. Sheriff Hutton, welcome.
Thank you, Chair. Would you like for me to address the comments or concerns that were brought forward on the amendment?
Yes. I'm not going to repeat them, but let me ask Representative O'Neill, perhaps, just to very concisely go over her question again.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. No, this is just a very expansive amendment, the A7, and so it almost is a full bill in and of itself. And so I just wanted to hear from the Sheriff's Association, are they in favor of this? Did they help in the drafting of it? And so I just want a little bit more testimony on the record, because again, this is a really meaty amendment. We don't normally put amendments on that are quite this expansive. This could be an entire committee hearing in and of itself. So I just wanted to hear kind of the process from you, like if there was any concern still with the Sheriff's Association, or is it good to go?
To the A7 amendment, Sheriff Hunt.
Thank you, Chair and Representatives. So we were very engaged with DLC in the discussions for this bill. We are just a little bit shy of completely supporting the recommendations that are coming forward on the bill. However, with regards to this amendment, Representative O'Neill, I would have to agree with you that it is very meaty. It's very significant. We also need to remember the various sizes of jails that we have within the state. We have jails within the state which are 4 to 6 inmates, and we have the size of Hennepin County. So this is not an easy amendment for us to have just seen, if you will, from last night to today. With regards to NAMI's comments about the conversations that were occurring during the rulemaking process, with many concerns were brought up specific to these recommendations by NAMI right before the prior inspector or the supervisor within the inspection unit left. We were engaged in these conversations for changes to the language.
Very well, thank you, Sheriff. Representative Bowley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Two things real quick. The first one is a parliamentary inquiry as far as the sequence of these amendments being added. The A1 amendment was a name change, and Representative Holland's amendment, the last line says, amend the title accordingly. I want to make sure that we're not canceling out A1 with this amendment, Mr. Chair.
It might be a good question for one of our legal counsel. Mr. Johnson or Mr. Diebel?
Mr. Chair, this is Jeff Diebel.
Mr. Diebel.
That instruction at the end of the amendment is the description of the bill, not the title within the bill that you adopted in the earlier amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Diebel. Representative Rowling?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And as long as we have the sheriff on, could we ask him to comment on the overall bill itself, Mr. Chair?
Certainly. I think what Chair Hutton said is that they're just shy of supporting the bill, but perhaps he might want to add another sentence or two, Sheriff Hutton.
Thank you, Chair. Representatives, yes. We did a lot of work with DLC. DLC carried, obviously, the larger share of this, and we had 4 sheriffs engaged very deeply on this. So we appreciate everything that DLC brought forward. Our concern, as you can imagine, would be how it is being or how it may be amended. And we've had those conversations with DOC to have further conversation after today. So I just want to give a shout out to DOC for in bringing us along the way.
Thank you, Chair. Members, we're ready to vote on the A7 amendment. I take it from the conversation we probably should do a roll call on this, and so the clerk will take the roll on the A7 amendment.
Chair Mariani?
Aye.
Chair Mariani, aye. Vice Chair Frazier?
Aye.
Vice Chair Frazier, aye. Representative Johnson?
No at this time.
Representative Johnson, nay. Representative Edelson?
Aye.
Representative Edelson, aye. Representative Feist?
Aye.
Representative Feist, aye. Representative Grossel, excused. Representative Hollins?
Aye.
Representative Hollins, aye. Representative Hewitt?
Aye.
Representative Hewitt, aye. Representative Cleavorn? Representative Cleavorn? Representative Long?
Aye.
Representative Long, aye. Representative Lucero? Representative Mueller?
Mueller votes no.
Representative Mueller, nay. Representative Novotny? Representative Novotny?
Novotny's.
If that could be
Novotny's repeated. Aye.
Thank you. Rep. Novotny, aye. Representative O'Neill?
O'Neill is a no.
Representative O'Neill. Representative O'Neill, nay. Representative Pinto?
Aye.
Representative Pinto, aye. Representative Poston?
Poston, no.
Representative Poston, nay. Representative Raleigh?
Raleigh, yes.
Representative Raleigh, aye. Representative Vang?
Aye.
Representative Vang, aye. Representative Zhang?
Aye.
Representative Zhang, aye.
Lucero, no.
Representative Cleavorn? That concludes roll call with 12 ayes.
Very well. Members with 12 ayes, you had 5 nays, clerk?
Yes.
Very well. With 12 ayes and 5 nays, the A7 amendment is adopted. Thank you, Representative Collins. Next, we have the A2 amendment. The chair will move the A2 amendment. Members, this amendment would insert a definition of use of force as must not be applied maliciously or sadistically for the purpose of causing harm to an inmate. Members, this language refers to a U.S. Supreme Court decision in 1986, by the way, a U.S. Supreme Court decision on what constitutes a violation of Eighth Amendment in the context of use of force within a prison setting. We heard testimony earlier that we're dipping into statutes that have not been changed, perhaps not even entertained, since 1904. And without commenting on what the standards were in 1904, I would say that it's time for us to align our standards with the clear intent behind this bill, which is in fact to prohibit abusive behavior. And that language and that construct, if you will, is in finding within the 1986 U.S. Supreme Court decision. So we would be basically establishing a minimal standard aligned with that expectation of our U.S. Supreme Court that clearly prohibits abusive behavior. I believe that that reflects what the standards probably should have been in 1904, but certainly should be in 2021. So with that, members, entertain any questions, discussion. Representative Johnson.
Chair Mariani, I have no problem with a voice vote on this. This should be the standard. I know with the corrections officers, I know, and the law enforcement officer, I know as well, they never want to use any more force than absolutely necessary. That's why they use the force continuum as their guide in all their training. And they do their best to weed out those that who actually do this and train not to use more force than absolutely necessary. So I have no problem with this amendment at all.
Thank you. Appreciate your support, Representative Johnson. All in favor of the A2 amendment, please say aye.
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 All same sign. Motion prevails, and the A2 amendment is adopted. The last amendment is the A4 amendment. I believe that's your amendment, Representative Johnson.
Chair Mariani, that is correct. This is my amendment. And actually, Commissioner Snell teed it up very well for me. He explained how important inspections are and stuff like that, and how important it is to have the proper inspections, making sure everything is being done properly, and also to follow up on those inspections. What this amendment does is also requires the Department of Corrections in the state facilities that we run to be inspected as well. Currently, every jail and any facility that houses people that are incarcerated are required to be inspected, except for the state prison system. This amendment requires that they also be inspected and that they can actually lose their license as well, following the same rules that are putting on the sheriffs and the group homes inside the Department of Corrections. We have the OLA report, and some of these issues were brought up in that. So I do ask for your support for this amendment. And I would like to request a roll call.
Very well. Representative Johnson moves the A4 amendment, and there will be a roll call. Representative Long.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Johnson, for bringing this amendment. Certainly, audits and assessments are important and a key part of ensuring that that facilities are up to the standards that the bill is setting. I unfortunately though will not be able to support the amendment at this time. It has annual inspections with the requirement of 5 separate individuals comprising those teams, and my understanding is that would potentially add additional cost to the bill, and I would need to understand that better. So I would hope that we could work together before we go to Ways and Means and with the Department of Corrections on what those costs might be.
Very well, Representative Long. Further discussion? Members.
Chair Mariani.
Yes, Representative Johnson.
Chair Mariani, I am disappointed in that, but I still think it is important that we do inspect our prison system and do them regularly. As the OLA report showed, that we have some deficiencies there, that the only way we're going to make sure that they're done properly is with inspections. The number of facilities that they have is minor compared to the 170 some facilities that they already inspect. Adding the number of prisons we have would be minor. Thank you. Please, I would ask that you do support the amendment.
Well, Representative Long, it will be my intention as chair to follow the lead of our author here. However, I do want to say for the record that I do think that Representative Johnson makes an important point here that I would hope as this bill moves forward, we can work together to address. I'm a big fan of independent assessments and audits, but I'm just one legislator. But I will be voting with you at this point and hoping that this conversation will continue going forward.
Chair Mariani?
We can come back with Representative Johnson.
I'm just wondering if Commissioner Snell could weigh in on this as well since he is here.
Certainly. Commissioner Snell.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, so I agree with you that the building in a inspection process is important. And as I mentioned in my earlier testimony, we have a plan to do that. with folks. In fact, in the what we're proposing is one of the suggested methods by the OLA. So we are actually following the very recommendation that they established. And I would also just note that at present in Minnesota, because there's no requirement of it, the correctional facilities that the state operates are not themselves licensed facilities. That would be something that would be a different requirement. We do, however, and I've made this commitment to the sheriffs, believe that we should be making sure that we are in full compliance with the very standards that we're suggesting and proposing.
Well, thank you. That's very helpful. All right, members, the clerk will take the roll on the A4 amendment. No.
Mr. Frazier? Vice Chair Frazier, no. Representative Johnson?
Yes.
Representative Johnson, aye. Representative Edelson?
No.
Representative Edelson, nay. Representative Feist?
Nay.
Representative Feist, aye. Representative Grossel?
No, nay.
Oh, nay. My apologies. Thank you. Representative Feist, nay. Representative Grossel, excused. Representative Hollins?
Nay.
Representative Hollins, nay. Representative Hewitt? Representative Cleavorne. Representative Cleavorne. Representative Long.
No.
Representative Long, nay. Representative Lucero.
Yes.
Representative Lucero, aye. Representative Mueller.
Mueller votes yes.
Representative Mueller, aye. Representative Novotny.
Novotny, aye.
Representative Novotny, aye. Representative O'Neill.
O'Neill, aye.
Representative O'Neill, aye. Representative Pinto.
No.
Representative Pinto, nay. Representative Poston.
Aye.
Representative Poston, aye. Representative Raleigh.
Raleigh, aye.
Representative Raleigh, aye. Representative Vang.
No.
Representative Vang, no. Representative Zhang.
No.
Representative Zhang, nay. That concludes, Representative Hewitt. Representative Cleavorne. That concludes roll call with 7 ayes and 9 nays.
With the vote of 7 ayes and 9 nays, the A4 amendment is not adopted. Representative Long, that concludes the amendments before us. We probably have about 10 minutes left in this committee, just a very few seconds, and then we'll move to your vote.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to thank the committee for hearing this bill today and for this important discussion, and in particular to thank Delshia and Brett for bringing forward their powerful stories. And I'm humbled to carry this bill in honor of Fardell and Brett, in particular with the renaming of the bill. And I'm hopeful that we can make progress on this bill this session to help address this urgent crisis.
Very well. Thank you, Representative Long, for bringing us a very good bill where we, in my opinion, need to act. With that, Representative Long renews his motion that House File 1267 as amended.
Chair Mariani.
Representative Johnson.
Yeah, I just wondered, I believe in the motion this went to Ways and Means. Is that correct?
That's the motion we have before us. Yes, sir.
I'm just wondering, there's some issues dealing that should possibly, especially with the one of the amendments put on here, it should go to Health and Human Services, and there's also some data issues that might need to go to civil law. I just want to make sure that we get it to the right place, because we might need to move it there, especially with that last amendment that was put on, major amendment put on dealing with mental health issues. I do believe it should go to Health and Human Services.
There certainly is a way for us to move it to Ways and Means and then move it to another committee and or to amend in Ways and Means, but I leave this to the author of the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't believe it needs to have another committee stop before Ways and Means, and I would like to keep the motion the same and would be happy to reach out to the chairs. Representative Johnson suggested to confirm that after the fact.
If you could reach those chairs, I would greatly appreciate it. Very well. Representative Long moves to refer House File 1267 as amended to the Ways and Means Committee. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Mariani.
Aye.
Chair Mariani, aye. Vice Chair Frazier. Vice Chair Frazier.
Aye.
Vice Chair Frazier, aye. Representative Johnson.
Aye.
Representative Johnson, aye. Representative Edelson.
Aye.
Representative Edelson, aye. Representative Feist.
Aye.
Representative Feist, aye. Representative Grossel, excused. Representative Hollins.
Aye.
Representative Hollins, aye. Representative Hewitt. Representative Hewitt. Representative Cleavorn. Representative Cleavorn. Representative Long.
Aye.
Representative Long, aye. Representative Lucero.
Yes.
Representative Lucero, aye. Representative Mueller.
Mueller votes yes.
Representative Mueller, aye. Representative Novotny.
Novotny, aye.
Representative Novotny, aye. Representative O'Neill.
O'Neill, aye.
Representative O'Neill, aye. Representative Pinto.
Aye.
Representative Pinto, aye. Representative Poston.
Aye.
Representative Poston, aye. Representative Raleigh.
Raleigh, aye.
Representative Raleigh, aye. Representative Vang.
Aye.
Representative Vang, aye. Representative Zhang.
Aye.
Representative Zhang, aye. Representative Hewitt. Representative Cleavorn. That concludes roll call with 16 ayes.
And the nays?
16 ayes, 0 nays, and 3 excused.
Very well, thank you. With 60 ayes and 0 nays, House File, the motion passes, and House File 1267, as amended, is referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. Thank you, Representative Long, and thank you for all the testifiers. Our hearts and thoughts with Brett Huber's family and with Delshay Perry as well. Members, we're not going to get to the other two bills. I'm told that I've got 2 minutes before they literally, well, not literally, but they'll electronically kick us off. However, I do want to say that I really do appreciate the spirit in which we engaged with these bills today, the honor that we gave them and to the families, and the way in which we engage with one another, I think in strong deliberation of the principles in these bills. And I look forward to ongoing engagement with one another as they move forward. So thank you so much for good work today, everyone. We'll get to those other bills, so we'll squeeze them in somehow in the next week or so. So members, with that, this committee stands adjourned.